evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And now, will the estimated 11 million immigrants, will the working class be scalded as stew of immigration bills reaches boiling point? And with us to discuss the issues that seem to be reaching a crescendo this week are Jeffrey Foe, co-founder of Economic Policy Institute and author of The Global Class War, Hector Figueroa, Secretary Treasurer of SEIU Local 32BJ, Nancy Morowick, co-director of the NYU School of Law Immigrants' Rights Clinic, and Ariana Renteria-Torres, Supervising Attorney, Immigrant Law Unit of the Westchester Hispanic Coalition, and Marianne Yang, Director of NYSDA Immigrant Defense Project, and I would say people who are very well situated to discuss this issue. And some of the things that we need to know, of course, are the onerous provisions that exist really in all of the bills that are being proposed. But maybe we can start with Jeff.
Jeff, you've just finished this book, The Global Class War, and as I've been seeing the news reporting on the immigration phenomenon in the United States, I don't see too much emphasis on looking at the global perspective, and especially the various trade agreements that the United States has entered into with, for instance, Mexico and Canada, CAFTA, Central America. Bring us up to speed on how this affects immigration to the United States.
Well, I think that immigration is you know, part of the globalization process, and specifically, you can look at the failure and see the failure of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was the prototype, which was the model for the World Trade Organization and the sort of and the global trade rules. You can see its failure. The problem of illegal immigration, undocumented workers coming across to the United States, risking their lives for, you know, jobs that may or may not even reach the minimum wage. It's a reflection of the failure of the so-called free trade agenda to do what it was promised. When NAFTA was first debated, Bill Clinton, and I'm quoting now, said there will be less illegal immigration because Mexicans will be able to support their children by staying home. Well, that didn't happen. Carlos Salinas, who was the Mexican president at the time, came to Washington during those years and told, asked Americans, well, you have a choice between Mexican tomatoes or Mexican tomato pickers. It was very, you know, raw and right up front that they were making this appeal that it would stop this illegal immigration from Mexico. Of course, it didn't, because it didn't create a middle-class prosperity in Mexico. And so immigration across from Mexico, undocumented workers coming in, have more than doubled since NAFTA was first put there. So what we're arguing about in the immigration bill and all the politics around it really is a reflection of the failure of the kind of globalization policies that we've been pursuing and in a large extent led the world in pursuing, the failure of those policies to deliver. So suddenly we're faced with this problem here, the politics of it, the tragedies of it, because we haven't solved the basic issues of how we're going to operate in this global economy. You look at the difference between how we have integrated North America and how the Europeans integrated Western Europe, and you learn some very important lessons. That when the European Union was first started, the French and the Germans and the Dutch, there was a lot of fear there because they thought they'd be overwhelmed by poor migrants from Greece and Spain and Portugal and even Ireland. And it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because, first, part of the deal was a generous transfer of investment funds for roads, for schools, for infrastructure, housing, and clean water from the rich countries to the poor ones. And second, the poor countries had to agree to abide by certain labor standards and human rights standards. That was all of that was absent from NAFTA. And in some ways, we're reaping the rewards right now.
Well, maybe this will glide seamlessly into Hector Figueroa, who is our labor expert, so to speak, today, who is the Secretary-Treasurer of 32BJ. Hector, how do you look at this issue and some of the debate? Of course, what always seems to me to be the case is that we don't enforce wage and hour rules in terms of workers here, which leads to exploitation and sometimes super exploitation. And of course, those are the issues that are not fueling the debate around immigration. But how does your union and your perspective take hold here? And I should say that Hector is also one of the people who's working very aggressively towards the April 10th demonstration on immigrants' rights. Hector?
Well, thank you. Now we have a very high standard to pursue. I agree with Jeff, if I may, on this issue of how globalization has really been met by ill-conceived policies like NAFTA, and that, you know, the deep root of the problem of immigration is that we have not addressed development in Mexico and the issue of workers' rights across the border and here in the States. But we also now have this reality of immigrant people who are here working in this country. Most of them are workers, just like you and me, trying to make a living. And we have seen in Congress a response in this H.R. 4437 bill sponsored by Sansenbrenner, our own local elected official, Peter Kim from Long Island, that virtually creates a state of a clearly underclass worker that not only will be exploited, but also now will become a federal felon. And those who try to improve the lives of these workers become federal felons too. This has taken a different turn in the Senate, but the way it looks to us is the turn that you take when you know that you're heading into the abyss, and then you change in the other direction, but you're still swimming against the current. What's been happening in the Senate is not yet what we need in this country, but it's a good step forward in the sense that now the discussion is moving politically towards legalization and to figure out how we deal with future flows of workers. Although the solution that have been presented thus far fell short of what we would call comprehensive immigration reform.
Now, Nancy and I were coming up together in the elevator, and one of the things that was just very casually said is, my goodness, it looks like what we're really moving to is less of legalization, et cetera, but more of the worst of each of the bills being synthesized during this next week. And certainly I want to ask our other guests what their perspective and understanding of what we may wind up with, and of course, what are the terrifying pitfalls within that for the immigrant communities. Nancy, I'm going to start with you since you made the offhand comment.
Well, I think the first thing that's very important to understand is that the enforcement provisions in the Senate are in many ways just as bad as the enforcement provisions in the House. People tend to think the Senate bill is much more pro-immigrant because it does have programs for legalization, and that's, of course, a very important part of that bill. But under the Senate bill, people who help people, you know, neighbors with babysitting, help a neighbor find a job, people who just do ordinary day-to-day human things will be criminalized just as they would be under the House bill. And in addition to that, there are many, many sort of basic human rights. I mean, rights to be brought before a judge if you're stopped on the street and charged with deportation, rights to sort of get fair process, to go to a court. There are many, many rights that are undermined by this bill. It's a bill that promotes detention and deportation in, you know, all through the bill. Now, the bill, when it came out, the final version of the Senate Judiciary bill is 477 pages long, and nobody actually got to sit down and look at the fine print until last Thursday. And when you started to look at that fine print, I mean, there were, just to give you an example, there was one provision that people tried to get in last year in the Real ID debate, which was a big debate last year on immigration law, and the conference committee didn't allow it. And suddenly this provision, which, you know, it might sound technical, but it has to do with whether you can get a court to stop deportation, you know, when you go to court, is back in, and it's snuck into a provision, you know, where you would never guess that it was inside that section of the bill. And that's the kind of problem we have, and I'm very worried that, you know, that even if we only had the Senate's enforcement provisions, it would be very bad.
I agree. A lot of us think that the laws in 1996 were horrible. They were a full-out assault on immigrants and were particularly horrible to lawful permanent residents who were living here for decades. And overnight, we saw, you know, working-class mothers being deported without any form of discretionary deportation waiver for such ridiculously minor offenses like shoplifting, you know, diapers or baby clothes worth $15. And basically those laws devastated entire immigrant communities, which are full of, you know, U.S. citizen family members as well. And there has been some coverage of H.R. 4437 and the bad enforcement provisions in the Sensenbrenner bill in the House, but I think it is high time for us to talk about how horrible these enforcement provisions are in the Senate bill that passed the Judiciary Committee, and also the FRIST bill, which is technically on the floor of the Senate as well. They expand the grounds of deportation. They authorize the use of domestic military bases for increased detention. They authorize local law enforcement to make calls on whether someone might be here unlawfully or not. Local law authorities generally having really no expertise at all in making those determinations. And a whole host of other things that basically in their totality create this mechanism to delegalize already lawfully residing people here in the U.S. And I question a policy that purports to legalize, and I think it would only legalize mere fraction of the 11 or 12 million undocumented people here in the United States. But I question that policy to legalize just to turn around and make it that much easier to delegalize those same people tomorrow.
Can we bring Adriana into the discussion as well, and in part because certainly you've spent considerable amounts of time in Mexico. Some of the immigration reality in the country is focused on Mexico, and I was hoping that you would add your voice to this discussion. And
I think that it's unfortunate to have yet another example of a fragmented policy towards migrants that give us the idea that this is the mechanism that is going to include or to bring 11 million people into the mainstream of protection and access to benefits in this country, and it does quite the contrary. It's yet another example of a law that refuses to assume accountability from the part of the administration for the ill-conceived, as has been said, policies that the regional policies that the United States has been advancing in Mexico and Central America since the 1980s. The reality is that immigration is not going to stop until the United States assumes the responsibility for the causes that generate the displacement of workers, the lack of opportunity and advancement for professionals in their own country, and that make us believe or try to make the population of the United States believe that immigration is a border security issue, that is a national and security issue that is going to be addressed with border security measures, and requires that the United States administration assumes a warlike stance towards migrants. We have heard in the last 10 years programs such as Gatekeeper, Hold the Line, programs that really try to deter people from coming into the United States through force and aggression, programs that were designed by the Department of State of Defense, law conflict or law level conflict department, that want to push the solution for the presence of migrants in our communities is to push them by force, rather than addressing the reasons why here in the first place. NAFTA and CAFTA are one of the examples of the reasons why these people are here, and where Central Americans and Mexico try to look into a better life in the United States rather than trying to create the conditions for sufficiency and self-sufficiency in their own countries. Since NAFTA was enacted, the engineers of NAFTA foresaw this displacement of peasants and the destruction of the economy. Basically, the small businesses, small business owners went lost their property, lost their enterprises to allow NAFTA to take over land, to take over the wealth, the raw materials that are necessary to sustain the economy of the Mexican state. So it's unfortunately to see yet another try at something that history has proved that has failed, a fragmented policy, a fragmented view that also tries to separate undocumented migrants, the worthy workers that work the fields, from the less worthy migrants, those who might have a criminal record. And I think that's creating division among advocates and division in the community.
Can I follow up on that? I think this is really important to give the listeners a sense of just how this thing, you know, works. One of the examples here in NAFTA was that the treaty called for the expansion of the exports from corn and wheat in the U.S. and Canada to Mexico. And even at the time of NAFTA, it was clear to everybody that this was going to hurt the small Mexican farmer who grows the corn and has a little co-op in the town and doesn't have a great life, but was able to survive. And when they opened the door to the flood of U.S. corn and Canadian wheat, it just blew, some of the estimates are 2 million people, 2 million farmers, just blew them out of the water in Mexico. And this was no accident. In my book, I have quotes from Mexican officials who said that's exactly what we wanted. We wanted to push people off the farm and put them, you know, move them into the cities, where they could be, an essentially, a low-wage labor force for industrial growth. Well, what happened, of course, is that most of the benefits of this kind of thing in Mexico went to the rich. The middle class actually shrunk, and you had workers displaced from the rural areas, no place to go in Mexico to find jobs, and so they came north. And it's not just that it was a mistaken policy. If you go back and read the documents and read those speeches, it's clear that that's how it was designed. So, you know, what seems now to be, well, gee, you know, this sort of disaster that's come up is not the result of an accident. And so the notion that this country and the leadership in this country has some responsibility here for what's been done, I think, is very, very important.
One of the ingredients that we've been missing so far is the guest worker program. It was introduced in the Kennedy McCain bill, but sort of the Bechtel hybrid, I call it, has a version of it also. And Hector, do you want to start a discussion on that?
Well, I'd like to make a discussion connected to what Jeff said. I agree with Marianne and Nancy about the bad provisions of this legislation, but I do not think this is really the result of fortune. It's not unfortunate. This is, like Jeff is saying, the natural consequence of how this integration has been moving forward, and also of the coincidence of factors here. You know, on the one hand, you have a heavy flow of immigrants from Mexico and other parts of the world. It's not just Mexico, and I think we should not restrict ourselves to Mexico, you know, because people are coming from Eastern Europe, from Africa, from Latin America. But also it coincided at the very moment in which the assault on working people in this country continued and was consolidated in the way that our economy has been functioning. Inequality is increased. Many of our traditional social contract, if you want to call it that way, have been eroded. Unions have been losing their power. Workers have been seeing the loss of health care, pension, happening at the very moment in which immigration is flowing in large numbers. So you have now a public out there that, unless we organize it and educate, a portion of the public can be easily directed by those who want to see immigrants as the culprit, to see immigrants as those who are partly responsible for our problem, as opposed to those who really are behind the way our economy functions and our government tries to to come up with the way to govern in this environment. And I think that it is those circumstances that are partly responsible for this kind of legislation. It's very bad in terms of enforcement. It's very bad in many ways. But what I think we should not underestimate is because of the actions that have been happening over the last few weeks, because of the pressure from the bottom, you know, the discourse has to shift in some way. Not too far away from the abyss, not too far away from the black hole that we were headed, but still, you know, changing in the direction of trying to talk about legalization. And, you know, the guest worker program is an example again. We could talk about individual provisions, but the way that we think about it in the labor movement is that we need to put tremendous pressure on the streets right now on making clear what we need. Legalization with a path to citizenship, worker protection, protection of civil rights, reunification of families. Even if those things are not contained in the way that we need in this legislation, because the process may end with no legislation. There may be no reconciliation of the Senate and the House bill, and we need to continue to raise our voices and organize ourselves for the long-term fight.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's also a reason for a framework for which to look at some of the enforcement provisions, because one of the things about the enforcement provisions is that they really act as impediments to that path to citizenship. And one example which has received no attention at all is that the bills create new bars to citizenship and for the first time in American history allow the government agency on its own to deny somebody citizenship. So in a sense, it's giving the power to have more and more second-class citizens, people who are always at risk of detention and deportation and not really able to reach citizenship and be able to participate as voters in the United States.
I agree. That's one great example. And it's just one of many in the Senate legislation, either in the chairman's mark that passed the judiciary or the first bill that includes these punitive mechanisms that apply to legal residents here and really have nothing to do or should have nothing to do with a debate on how to grapple with the 11 million undocumented immigrants here in the country.
Another way of thinking about it is, you know, and these bills, in a sense, are being designed as massive registration programs. I think the underlying logic of these bills is that you seal the borders as though that were possible. You then require everybody within the country to register, and then you deport all the ones who don't meet the requirements of this program. And that then becomes the logic for imposing criminal penalties on people who are not given these temporary visas and so on. And when you look at the fine print of all of this, it really winds up being largely a report to deport program. Nobody's going to come forward for that, and then people who don't come forward will be all the more marginalized. And I think that's why a true legalization, a true program which gives people a real right to come forward and to obtain status is what's really needed and what people need to be raising their voices for.
And voices have been raised on those lines. I think that perhaps what I would say is a big strategic challenge right now is, do we focus our efforts in going after the Senate bill and talking about all the negative things in the Senate bill, which I think there are many, and I would never characterize this bill, and I don't think anybody who's been organizing in the immigrant communities characterizes this bill as pro-immigrant. But at the same time, we are facing a real, you know, juncture in which it's important that even the shy, weak provisions that the Senate version has try to prevail over this process, so the bill at a minimum is not reconcilable with the bill from the House, because then we can certainly get them to become law. And I think that, you know, part of the game that we are in right now is that, unfortunately, a bill that doesn't really grant all the things that we need is out there, which happen to be of a different genetic makeup, even though it has the same features of the bill in the House. The bill in the House is only about enforcement, and the bill in the Senate, with all the problems that it has on enforcement, still raises the issue of legalization, albeit in all these restrictive ways, and the issue of what to do with the future flow. And in some sense, it would be difficult to reconcile the two. So the question is, do we go for a moment in which we try to say no immigration bill should be passed, or should we try to concentrate on the things that we think a legislation should have, so we take this attention, this moment of attention that the country has on the problem of immigration to A, try to tell the country who the real immigrants are. They're working people just like everybody else. What our basic demands are. And to make sure that those who are thinking about reintroducing this kind of legislation in the future, which would probably be the scenario we'd contemplate, pay some political cost for what they're doing. When you look at somebody like Peter King, and you look at Sansenbrenner, and you look at the race in November, one question that we need to ask, are those people going to continue in the House? Are some of those folks continue in the Senate? There is a very strong likelihood that they will. And unless we figure out a way to advance, you know, our agenda in a way that changes the political climate, we're not going to have the bill that we actually need. There is no condition for it to pass now. There are no conditions for it to pass in the immediate future. But there is a huge attention to the problem right now and a strategic need to prevent the version from the House to become law in a way that it reconciles itself with the Senate version.
Ha llegado la noticia muy alegre que de verlo es diferente. Pues el pueblo ya está en contra de los rancheros y engreídos que acababan con la gente.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. And Jeff Foe, who is the author of The Global Class War, Hector Figueroa, Secretary Treasurer, SEIU Local 32BJ, Nancy Morowitz from the NYU School of Law Immigrant Rights Clinics, and Ariana Renteria Torre, Supervising Attorney of the Immigrant Law Unit in Westchester Hispanic Coalition, and Mariana Yang, Director of NYSDA with the Immigrant Defense Project.
Viva la revolución, viva nuestra asociación, viva huelga general.